This is the Game Designers of North Carolina podcast.
Hello, and welcome to episode 24 of the Game Designers of North Carolina podcast, the most paralyzing podcast in the business. My name is Matt Wolf, and I'm your host. Our topic for this episode is reducing analysis paralysis. And with me this time are two designers who had so much paralysis on deciding if they actually wanted to do this topic. First one is Mark McGee. Hey, Mark.
Hello.
That was very typical for Mark. And also with us is Graham Russell. Hey, Graham.
How's it going, Matt?
Very well. I'm very happy that both of you are here so we can talk about this topic here. But before we get to our main topic, we're going to do our first segment, which is What's in the Oven? And Graham, what have you been working on lately?
Yeah, well, so lately I've been, unsurprisingly for me anyway, I've been gearing up for an entry for a design competition. I like them a lot. Button Shy Games is doing a nano game competition. I had an idea that has kind of been languishing on the back burner for a couple of years, and the constraints of this contest made it kind of interesting to see if I could fit it in that. Yeah, I love these sorts of like very small constraint competitions. It really makes you focus on what exactly works and cutting as much as you possibly can. It's a lot of fun. So yeah, I've been working on a two-player cooperative game that is at least at the moment. We'll see how it shakes out by the end of the month. But right now it is about running a road crew in a blizzard. We'll see where it goes. But I'm going to test that at the meeting this week, and it'll blow up or not blow up.
Very cool. How about you, Mark? What you been working on lately?
Most of my time lately has been working on Galaxy Alpha Team Number One Go. I'm going to be taking it to a local con in a couple weeks, just getting some more eyes on it, doing some playtesting with some people who've never seen it before. And then I'm hoping that at that point I can be more, do more shopping it around with some publishers or whoever, see if there's any interest, because it's turning out to be a lot of fun. And I think it is my most publishable design yet.
I would agree with that. I think it's shaping up really nicely, and it's definitely at that stage where you're at the refinement stage. It feels like the core is real good, and it's just a matter of making sure that the decisions remain consistently good, and that the game remains fun. And once you get that, yeah, it's going to be really, really strong.
Yeah, the difference between the best game design and the most publishable game design, there are huge differences, and that's probably an entire episode we should do sometime, but that's not this one.
That's going to be a bummer episode, so I don't know if we want to.
Important, though. Look, I had to learn the hard way, so how about we give some people a break?
I mean, that episode is going to be 5 minutes. It's going to be, just because it's good doesn't mean anyone wants to actually publish it. Your game about, the smuggling meth, that's not something that's going to get published. Sorry.
Well, what about a gerrymandering game?
A gerrymandering game? Ugh, no. All right. Yeah, there you go. There's a special bonus episode in the middle of this episode.
Yeah.
All right. So let's dive into our main topic here, which is reducing analysis paralysis. And so first of all, let's make sure that we define analysis paralysis, or AP for short. And we're just going to call it AP from now on, because analysis paralysis is too much to say. I actually stole a definition from Wikipedia, which I thought was pretty good. Analysis paralysis, or AP, is the state of overanalyzing or overthinking a situation so that a decision or action is never taken, in effect paralyzing the outcome. And I think that all of us have probably experienced this, at least maybe not ourselves, but someone in a game that we're playing with has succumbed to AP, and we're sitting there like, come on, come on. Okay, all right.
Yeah.
Come on. All right.
to, to get it out of the realm of, you know, dictionary style definitions, what we're talking about is not just pure indecision. People can have indecision that's not analysis paralysis, right? It's a form of indecision based on there being a lot of stuff to consider that you kind of have to have in a loop where you can't finish considering it. You can have two options that are obvious to you that are just, you can't decide even though you know all the outcomes, and that's not necessarily analysis paralysis, right?
That's probably a blurry line, but
yeah. I think that in many cases, I think that indecisiveness and analysis paralysis to the people who are not the person who's doing it can seem exactly the same.
That's definitely true. It's definitely a form of indecision. I just think that maybe we can limit our scope a bit.
I think that at least when it comes to multiplayer Euro-style games, which is probably going to be the bulk of kind of our viewpoint here, it could also be a Mary-style games. But I think that, at least in my experience, that AP really happens in multiplayer Euro-style games where you have a lot of things to consider. I think where most people would recognize is that someone is taking some time to make a decision, and it's a much longer duration than like anyone else at the table is taking to make a similar decision. Whether it's could be the exact same options, or it could be different options, but you know, somewhat similar. But they're, you know, one or multiple players are taking way, way, way longer than anyone else at the table or a typical player perhaps would take. Does that make it a little bit more of a colloquial definition?
I think so. There are some exceptions that we might try to get to a little later for that kind of definition, but for now, we can probably just jump in.
Okay. So, first of all, to see if we're on the same page here, do you guys think that AP is a bad thing? So what do you think, Mark?
I think that largely it can, yeah, in summary, yes. But I think that largely it can have a negative impact on the majority of players in the game. So, like, if I'm a person who is having analysis paralysis, then what I'm doing is I'm negatively impacting the other players at the table. And since the other players at the table frequently will outnumber me, which I might be having a fine time, I'm just taking my own time and being really slow. But since there's probably more other players, what that does is the net impact to the experience is negative, just drawn out stuff.
Yeah, and I think it depends on the group what the acceptable level is, right? But if people are just thinking through at a level that isn't bothering anyone, that's not analysis paralysis. That's just analysis.
Yeah, and that's fair. Yeah, as long as like the group is okay with whatever duration it takes a player to you know, process and make a decision for that group, then it wouldn't be any kind of AP. But yeah, if one or multiple people at the in the group that are playing the game are, you know, kind of drumming their fingers on the table, then yeah, at that point, it's probably going to be a pejorative experience for those players.
Right.
And I think, again, as I said, I think, you know, this viewpoint is largely comes from multiplayer Euro games. I'm having trouble thinking of like a party game that would suffer from AP. I don't know if you guys might like have an example off the top of your head.
I mean, how about something like The Resistance? Sometimes you're so torn between, oh, this person said this thing and this person acted in this way, so maybe that means this, or maybe that means they think that I think that that means this, or maybe that means that they think that I think that maybe they think that that means that.
Yeah.
In which case, you keep on trying to decide who you're going to pick as the traitor. You can't make a decision from there.
Yeah, I think social games in general, you know, it depends on what your definition of a party game is, but social games, whether it's paralysis or not, thrive on that sort of circuitous thinking that, you know, the whole thing is like the duel of wits. It's, you just want people, you want to confuse people, and that's the entire point of the game. Whereas in a Euro, it's maybe more of a pure problem that someone's just sitting there and slowing it down rather than being something you really want to cause in other people.
Right. I think for me, I wouldn't necessarily classify The Resistance as a party game. It's a large group social game, but to me, that's different from a party game. To me, like a party game would be Time's Up, Title Recall, or like Reverse Charades or Cards Against Humanity, Telestrations, things like that.
Telestrations. What about Codenames? Is that party?
Yeah, I think Codenames is...
You could see some of that in that.
Yeah, I think I could imagine that happening.
That I think that's a good point, actually. And I have witnessed that where the spy master for one of the teams is churning through their possible words or for codename pictures, their pictures, and they're trying to figure out a clue to give. And yeah, you're right. I think that is a party game that can have some analysis paralysis in it. Yeah, that's a really good example of a non-Euro kind of game. How about an Ameri style game? I think that Ameri style games largely aren't what we play, but you guys have any examples off the top of your head of one that might cause a lot of AP?
I mean, that really depends on how you define that thing, right? Like, they're definitely really miniatures focused Western games that feel a lot like war games, which war games thrive on this too, right? Of trying to think basically like 14 steps down the road for every possible outcome. That's kind of what it is, right? But yeah, I mean, they're definitely, I'd say it's more of a question of weight rather than genre, right? There are even Euros that don't have that much AP problem.
Oh, sure. Yeah. Yeah. It's definitely some formula of a magnitude of outcome of the decision you're going to make. And I think that is tied to weight in some type of manner. And what exactly that relationship is, you know, we'll have to see if we can kind of discuss that and maybe approximate some kind of answer. But yeah, I mean, there's definitely lighter Euros, like something like, I don't know, World's Fair 1893. Like that's a lighter Euro that I think for most people doesn't cause too much AP. But for something like, oh, I don't know, Trajan, that's something, I don't know. Have you guys both played Trajan?
I played it once a while ago.
Yeah, I generally don't play as many games that are prone to analysis paralysis.
Right.
Okay, that's
heavy games to take a while. Not my thing.
That's fair. Yeah, I mean, Trajan is a great game, but boy, can that just really paralyze you when you're trying to manipulate the Mancala mechanism and trying to figure out exactly what you want to do and adding that spatial aspect that some people have trouble processing to a heavy Euro.
You know, for Ameri style games, like I was thinking when I played Descent. Every time at the end of a mission when you could like buy upgrades and stuff, many times that's when we would just call it a night because considering the upgrades that you buy, that has such an impact over the whole rest of the campaign. And so some people would just kind of sit there and like look at all the possible options and then they would have to, yeah, just figure out every conceivable impact of every conceivable decision before they could decide on which upgrade to buy.
So did you like wait until the next session to decide on the upgrade then?
Yeah, we often did.
Huh. That's very interesting because that might be one of the aspects of AP that causes of AP that we're going to talk about. That could be an outcome of decision fatigue. Is you guys, you know, had like, what's Descent, like 2 hour sessions?
Yeah. About 2 hours.
Yeah. So you guys had like a 2 hour session playing the game, presumably made a bunch of decisions in the game, and now you're at the end you just might have decision fatigue at that point. And yeah, that's pretty interesting. I haven't played Descent myself, so I haven't had that experience. So, and let me ask, before we get into some of the causes of AP, let me ask you if there are any games where you yourself have experienced AP. So Graham, is there anything off the top of your head where were you just kind of locked up while you were playing?
I mean, of course, right? There's no end to games where you get hit with this stuff. I have one that I want to talk about a little later though.
Okay, that's fine. Mark, do you have any other example other than Descent?
You know, sometimes I feel like I can get a little bit slow in my decisions in a game. I'm not sure how slow they actually are in other people's perspectives, but I play a lot of Battleline, and I'm not going to say that I take like 20 minutes to make one turn in Battleline, but you get to those places where you have like a five and you can either put it over here and have like an open straight draw that you're looking for. You need like either the six or the three to fill up your straight, or you can put it in a stack of fives where you just need more fives. You know, one thing that's more likely to happen and one that is less likely to happen, but it's more likely to win if you do happen. And so I'll sit there and I won't know really what to do, but I've gotten to the point where in those sort of situations, I just do it anyway, because if I'm going to take a long time making a decision, I could just play a whole other round of the game.
Okay, yeah, I can totally see someone locking up in Battleline. So what do you think is the cause of the AP in Battleline for you?
That one is because I think the odds... So I know, due to my relationship with numbers, that there is a choice that is more likely to make me win But I know that the way the game is set up, calculating the odds for that is extremely difficult to get it exactly right. Like counting how many cards, you know, have been played, how many cards are still left in the deck, whatever. There's so many variables, and the exact solution is findable, but very difficult. So I sit there and I'm like, you know what? I should be smart enough to figure out which one's more likely to happen. And then I sit there, try to solve this problem that that even if I were like a super mathematic person, I could, it might take me 2 hours to solve. I don't know. And so I sit there trying to go down that lane, but then I just bail.
So are you trying to make the perfect decision?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. So I think this is the first cause that we're going to talk about here. So one thing that can drive AP is a player trying to make the perfect decision in the game. And so for something like Battle Line, what is it, do you think, that's preventing you from making that perfect decision? Is it just that the decision tree is too much to be able to calculate in a reasonable amount of time?
Yeah. I mean, I think you can ballpark it really quickly, but I think that finding the exact calculation to figure out if you know, between these two choices, if one of them is 40% likely to succeed and one of them is 35% likely to succeed, figuring out which one has that 5% better chance is extremely difficult just because of, yeah, just how many things are part of that calculation.
Hmm. Yeah. And we can't, like, this isn't one where having, you know, the perfect solution be hard to figure out is necessarily a problem, right? If you make it so easy that to figure out what the perfect thing is every time, what you're making is you're making tic-tac-toe and, right, you know, you're making a solved game, which actually is a problem. So there's a degree of this that really needs to be in there, right? But the game needs to encourage people to accept less than 100% certainty, I suppose.
Yeah, and so in that game specifically, a large part of it is, you know, having a ballpark idea of what the odds of your options are. The other part is making the odds more difficult for your opponent to figure out by not playing cards that would give them more information or playing cards that might give them false information so that when they ballpark their odds, they're a little bit different. So the way I justify not doing the complex math in my mind is just assuming that my opponent may have already played some slightly misleading information already. So then what I do is, instead of trying to figure out the optimal solution via math, try to figure out the optimal solution via knowing my opponent, which then it becomes easier for me to stop thinking about it because that is a much more difficult problem. And so I don't even attempt to solve it.
I gotcha. Do you usually play with your wife or someone else?
Yep.
Yeah.
Yeah. Almost exclusively with my wife.
Okay. So do you think the reason why you want to like focus on the perfect decisions in Battle Line is because, you know, it's basically a cards with numbers game. And right, so there's not like a lot of trying to obscure the,
right,
the, you know, the math probabilities in the game.
Yeah. It's very clear that there is a math problem there. Mm-hmm. It is abundantly clear. There's no avoiding that there is a math problem. I think that is so clear that it's very easy to not realize that there also is a bluffing and misleading and kind of guessing your opponent part of it, because that part is much more subtle. And a large part of that is because the math problem is so obvious.
Yeah, I definitely agree with that. I actually like Battle Line quite a bit. I'm not a huge Knizia fan. I think a lot of his stuff is thinly disguised math problems, and that's not the kind of games that I tend to like. But I do like Battle Line, and I think it is because of the player's ability to, you know, bluff and misdirect and things like that. And I think you're exactly right. Like on a first play, I don't know whether you would necessarily catch on to that, but I think after playing once or twice, I think most people do catch on to it at that point, and they say, oh, okay. Yeah. There's a lot more going on than just calculating probabilities in the game. So I wonder if you somehow, and I don't know how you could do this with Battle Line or if you even could do it, but if you could make the game so it would be less cards with numbers to make it less obvious about the probabilities, do you think that that would be a way to try to direct players away from making a perfect decision? Or do you think just because of the way that this game is designed that, you know, there just isn't going to be a good way to prevent players from trying to seek out that perfect decision?
You know, I'm not sure if I can mentally divorce the cards with numbers and the rest of Battle Line. Because so much of Battle Line is trying to make your opponent misjudge their odds of winning each flag.
Yeah. Have you played this, Graham?
Now I'm more of a Knights of Charlemagne guy. It's a 2 to 3 player game. And if you play a straight odds game with 3 players instead of 2, that makes it a lot less. There's a lot less of an AP problem because there's a third faction.
So why is there less of an AP problem?
Because you don't. It's fairly easy to go through the full calculations if you know the things that you don't have are the things that the other person has, right? That's a lot easier than saying, well, here's what I have. Then both of these people have their things, and I don't know who has what, and not everything each of them does is going to be directed straight at me. It obscures the odds because you don't know how people are going to play which way because their attention's divided, as is yours.
I think that's similar to how I make myself not be paralyzed with analysis in Battleline is acknowledging that the real problem is understanding human psychology and their motives and the reasons behind all their actions, which I think is pretty well understood to be either completely unsolvable or borderline unsolvable. And I think that you're less likely to try spinning your wheels solving an unsolvable problem than try spinning your wheels solving something that you know is solvable, even if you don't know how to solve it.
I think that's true.
So Knights of Charlemagne, I have not played that one. Is it similar to Battleline? Is it the same designer?
Yeah. So it's similar because most of his designs are similar.
Oh, hey now. Don't be a Knizia hater. Come on.
Like I said, I like the game a lot. And I think that game is undervalued, especially because it can play 3. It's fairly similar. We should give it a try sometime.
And it's still cards with numbers? Is that what it is?
It is cards with numbers and colors, yes.
Okay. All right. Okay. So I think for a player trying to make perfect decisions, it sounds like there's probably not a huge amount that a designer can do other than maybe trying to do a better job of obscuring the probabilities within the game, and which is going to be really difficult to do with a cards with numbers kind of style of game. But I think something that actually I think does a really good job with obscuring the probabilities is Camel Up. Have you guys both played Camel Up?
No.
No, I haven't gotten the opportunity yet.
So first of all, I think Camel Up is a really good game. I mean, obviously it won Spiel des Jahres, so the Germans at least like it. The decision space in that game is surprisingly vast in the sense that when you have 5 dice and none of them have come out yet, trying to calculate the probabilities at the beginning of a round is just ridiculous. So no one tries to do it. When you're later in the round and you only have like 2 dice left, depending on how the camels, what their positioning is on the track, it's probably pretty obvious whether a decision is going to be better or not. If the blue die comes out before the white die, like that's going to be way better, so I should do this thing. If the white die comes out before the blue die, that's not quite as good. But if I still do that thing, that's not going to hurt me too much. But you don't have to actually go in and try to calculate the exact probabilities of, okay, first if it's die order, and then if they roll a 1, 2, or 3, and then, you know, trying to go down that entire decision tree. I think at least I have not seen anyone really have any kind of serious AP in a game of Camel Up, even though it's totally about probability, just like how Battleline has a very large probability element to it as well. So, okay, how about too large a change in this game state to process, or the rapid increase of new information? So let's talk about this one. So what's the issue here for people that have AP?
So the one that interests me the most is the idea of a changing game state, right? Because one game in particular that I think does a really good job of managing AP, despite being a game that could really, really spiral out of control, is Five Tribes. It's when you see it on the table for the first time, especially for a Days of Wonder game, it looks crazy. It looks like I'd say maybe more of a standard Euro than something as approachable as a Days of Wonder title, because it's got all of these pieces everywhere and people are doing crazy things. And even when you sit down to play, you know, at the beginning of a game, there's a lot of options available to you. But on a given turn, someone's picking up a thing and dropping it off and maybe changing three or four of the options, right? You don't have to recalculate everything on the board. You just have to recalculate this places that got a meeple or places that took one away. That really allows you to only have to do three or four more calculations and not, you know, 40 every round. I think that's really helpful for that sort of game. But then there are games that really try to shake it up, often to real detriment.
Okay, so for Five Tribes, have you played that with like four players?
Yeah, I've played three, four, or five. Yeah.
Does it go up to five players?
I tried it once. I tend to try things once.
Oh. Okay. Yeah, I was gonna say, was that an expansion or
that's just me trying to. I like playing games one player above or below the required amount to see why they break. I think it's really instructive.
It's good to have hobbies. Okay.
Yeah. Like game design. Come on, Matt.
That's really interesting that for you that you feel that Five Tribes doesn't have too much of an AP issue, because I have played Five Tribes at four players. And I don't know, like, I kind of felt like if you're going last in that round, that you can't do a lot of kind of pre-planning. And maybe that's just my issue. Maybe most people don't have that issue.
I won't say that there's no AP in that game. There's just less because of some decisions they made. And I think that was smart.
Okay. I gotcha. Yeah. Mark, have you played Five Tribes?
Nope.
This is a great episode.
Is there a game you can think of, Mark, where the game state just changes so much before your turn that you can't kind of do like pre-processing before your turn?
Here's one that has what I feel like is the same issue. It's not the game state changes massively, but so much stuff changes right before your decision that you can't pre-plan your decisions. I'm talking about Alien Frontiers. Part of that is because you roll your dice at the very beginning of your game, of your turn. So you might have, if you wanted to pre-plan, you would have to come up with like, you know, six different options. If I get this, then this. If I get this, then this. And you know, planning six potential turns also takes a lot of time. And just the fact that even the player right before you can claim the last available space in an area that you would really want to use. So yeah, right up until it is the instant that you have to act, things are still changing. So pre-planning is just hampered by all those things.
Though also, I think planning in the moment is helped because everybody else doesn't have their values they're studying yet. So you can't take those into account, right? Mm-hmm. So you can only rely on what you have, and you don't necessarily know. You can't follow the decision chain through everyone else if they'd rolled at the end of their last turn, for example.
Yeah, I actually agree with both. I agree that rolling at the beginning of your turn, especially once you start to get like six dice, all, you know, that can, depending on what you roll, just cause you to just kind of like, okay, let me process through all the different things that I can do. But because everyone else's dice, they're still on the board, they, you know, you don't have to consider all the values that they have also rolled. Yeah, that actually sort of reduces the AP from that vantage point, attempts to at least allow players to be able to make a decision. It would be, I think, this is just speculation, but I imagine like if the game instead was everyone roll their dice and then you take turns placing your dice out there, you know, like one or two or three at a time, depending on what spot on the board you're going to, I imagine that would be an AP Kingsburg nightmare. Well, Kingsburg, you're rolling, is it three or four dice max? I can't remember anymore.
It tops out at five.
Five.
Plus maybe two, depending on what you do, maybe three. The thing that Kingsburg does to fight it is that it incentivizes using multiple dice at a time.
Right.
So it makes those options great, and therefore it kind of pushes what options you have down to a minimum at the beginning, which is when it is most needed.
So that, I think, is going to kind of lead into a really another really good way to try to reduce AP. And I think you're exactly right, Graham, where you're saying Kingsburg tries to incentivize options and make options a little bit more obvious of using multiple dice. So you will be able to I guess, reduce the decision tree for other players on their turns. And so one cause of AP can be when you have too many similar options.
Right.
You know, or if you are lacking a kind of a heuristic to be able to compare and process those options, which I think can be synonymous. Those can be maybe slightly different as well. But I think a lot of times, if your game just like, you know, if you have eight options that you could do right now, and six of them, it feels like they're going to get you to about the same kind of thing, that is just going to make players just absolutely lock up. And you're like, okay.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think that's incredibly common at the start of a game, especially if you haven't like started to pursue a strategy. A lot of strategies are equal to you, right? And there's a fairly common way to fix this. And I think the most distilled game that does it is Colorado. Have you played Colorado?
Yes,
I have. It's okay. It's been a little while, but yeah, Colorado is a good one.
But the idea is you're collecting certain colors and you know, you want to have more of fewer colors and all that. But what the game does that's so smart and fixes about six problems with it is it starts every player with one card of one color. Now, what that does, in addition to making players different so that it's almost like a variable player power at that point, it starts people on different footing. But it also makes it so, okay, if this situation, all things being equal, there's now a deciding factor for you. It's either take the thing that is better for you or deprive someone of that. That's a really easy tiebreaker and gets past that early game so you can start moving toward things. There are, of course, more complicated games that have, again, player powers and things that make it so, sure, the game is balanced, all the decisions are equal, but for you, there's something that will at least push you in a direction when you're kind of stuck.
Yeah, I think that's a great example and a great way to overcome the too many similar options issue. And you're right, a lot of games do kind of seed the player with something at the beginning, whether it's like a game that has like a hidden goal, or if it's just a game that just gives you, you know, some starting resources or something like that. Yeah, I think that, that's a great way to give a player some direction to, at least at the beginning of the game, to make those options something that's able to be parsed and actually differentiate them.
I think that's one of the big reasons why so many games have variable player powers is because it gives people a reason to pick one decision over another, especially near the beginning of the game where things otherwise might be equal. So yeah, I think there's several other reasons, but I think that's part of it and why people like variable player powers, unequal setup, asymmetric games.
That's an interesting point. I hadn't thought about variable player powers in the sense of trying to reduce AP at the beginning of a game, but that makes a lot of sense. That could definitely be one of several reasons why, you know, a lot of people like games that have variable player powers. I know the Voyages of Marco Polo that came out, I think that was just last year. That's a Euro where each player has individual player powers, and they're like, for a Euro, they're like crazy, like good player powers. Like one of them just gives you 10 points at the beginning of the game. You get 10 points. So everyone else is behind by 10 points, which is like, that's such a crazy thing to think about in a Euro mindset, but people love that game and it's ranked very highly on BGG. And I'm curious now if a lot of the really good response rate to that game, in addition to the variable player powers, is because it does give people, you know, like an immediate direction at the beginning of the game and helps them overcome that initial AP hurdle that can hamper some Euro games, especially, again, you know, the multiplayer Euro games.
Yeah, I mean, think about Cosmic Encounter, which is not a Euro game, but all those powers, the power that you have as your character from the get-go, drives so many of your decisions. I think without those in Cosmic Encounter, you know, many decisions would feel meaningless. You wouldn't really have as much guidance as to what to do.
Yeah, I mean, Cosmic Encounter isn't a game with variable player powers so much as it's variable player powers with some sort of like minor game thing in the middle of it. Like very little of the game is off of those cards.
Right.
Back to what you said about the 10 point player power. I think that sort of thing is, just from a game design perspective, a pretty good sign that they know what they're doing, because
right.
it's great to build a baseline variable player power, and that just sounds like, from the design work I've done, like, okay, what are these, how good are these player powers going to be? Okay, well, one of them's 10 points, and everything has to be balanced to that. And of course, you could take that out if you don't want to be that obvious, but it's really good to have a, like, just a milepost like that, and then balance everything to match.
Oh, totally. Yeah, I think, yeah, most likely they kind of decided we want the power unit to be like 10 points, and they figured out everything else in the game to kind of revolve around that, or at least the variable player powers part of the game, to make sure that they'd be approximately worth around 10 points if they are played well throughout the game.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. All right. Mark, pick out another cause that you want to talk about.
I choose too much information. I think that this touches on something that you mentioned a little while ago about having heuristics, problem-solving heuristics. So, for instance, a thing that computers do is computers can take a lot of information, and it is very straightforward for them to just brute force their way through all the information and come up with the right answer. But for humans who are less like computers in that sense, they cannot power their way through a massive amount of information to come up with the correct answers quickly. And so I think that too much available information is one of those things that it can, people who are prone to solving problems using a brute force heuristic are more susceptible to having analysis paralysis in games that provide more information. I think that there are people who have different heuristics, like ranking all your preferences as to types of moves that you want to do. Like, I'm going to, if given the option, I will buy sheep. And whenever that's the option, you don't have to do any brute force calculations. You just buy sheep. And so I think that's something that, you know, you hear about, oh, AP is a player problem, not a game problem. And I think that this is an example where it's more evident that there are players who are more susceptible to AP in games that have information, so much information that it's hard to brute force your way through it.
Yeah, and I think there are two aspects to it, right? Like, there's too much information just in pure volume, but there's also too much information in terms of a percentage, right? Like, if you have all information available, no matter if it's even like a smaller amount, having everything available makes it so you want to follow the decision chain all the way through. And that can be a problem, that if every bit of information is available to you, then you, like we were talking about, you want to find that perfect solution, and it's like all the information is there and you can do it. Where, like, if a game is good at not presenting all the information all at once, then you have much less of that problem.
Yeah, I mean, think about chess, a theoretically solvable game. All the information, all the possible moves are things that you can know up front. And even when they're trying to make computer programs to win chess, they don't win. The computer programs are not coded to do just straight brute force calculations. They do, like, you know, learning AI and pattern recognition, things like that are more similar to the way that humans can think, I guess.
So yeah. For a game that, or I guess, so first of all, if a game just has so much information that it causes the players who are going to, be slightly more computer-like in their information processing, is that something that the designer should try to design around, or is that just something that you would live with?
I think it's heavily dependent on who you're appealing to, but I think that a game would have broader appeal and be more widely recognized as being good and fun and playable if you limit that, because there are people who try to think through everything in a straightforward way and cannot get to the end of a very, 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 very long string of potential decisions. So, yes, yeah. So I think that, like, limiting the horizon of how far forward you can look is a way to kind of combat that specific aspect of AP.
Yeah, you can always go the other direction, right? You can say, all right, I'm going to make this really analysis-heavy, perfect information, abstract game. The thing you got to do there is make a game that is better than chess. So good luck. if you go down that road, there's so much of a chance that you will make something solvable, which ends up not being fun for anyone, at least past the game where anyone in your game group solves it. So I guess it's possible. There are games, right? There's chess, there's Go. There are games that do this, but it's a dangerous road to go down.
So think about it. If chess had a thing where every two turns, you count up the pieces that you have left and you add that to your score. So rather than the only way to win is by a checkmate or making your opponent quit. You have a more, I guess, in, you're effectively making it into a more tactical game. You have to win more short-term battles. Something, I mean, may or may not work. I just thought of it right now. But
right.
But then what you have to do, you don't have to think 60 moves in advance. I have to think 2 moves in advance because I'm scoring in 2 moves. So even in that scenario, all the information does still exist. But because you have a good place to stop, because the impact of that move will be recognized in short order rather than only recognize the impact of this move in 2.5 hours.
Hmm. Okay. So yeah. Is the way to address too much information, is it simply to reduce the amount of information, or is there any other way to attack that problem?
I mean, I think there's a combination of things you can do, right? Depending on whether the design works, you can obscure the way things go. You can, you know, reveal some things. You can limit. It's all about scaling back where it doesn't hurt your game, right? Which is different for anyone's design.
Hmm. Okay.
Yeah, I mean, games with a decent amount of randomness in there, like drawing cards or whatever, the randomness can be made such that it's basically impossible to predict what the state will be in 3 turns, because every turn something is slightly altered by randomness, and if it, you know, 3 randomnesses from now, it could be anything. So then all of a sudden you've limited any reason to think beyond 3 turns.
At least for, and, you know, normal people.
Yeah.
I mean, you're always going to have someone that's going to, you know, not realize, or maybe realize but still try to overthink, right? I mean, that's just, there's nothing you're going to do about that person, unfortunately. But yeah.
If you want to have the second part of this conversation, then you can have Garry Kasparov on the next episode. But I think that's about all we can say.
Yeah, my buddy Garry, I'll just call him up and see if he wants to be on the
show. He's on Twitter.
Yeah. Okay. So the next one, let's talk about the unclear game UX. So I think, Graham, this is one that you could probably talk reams about.
Yeah. So I think the most important thing for reducing AP in a game is to make sure all your information is glanceable, so that you can look over at what, you know, what everyone has, what the board state is, and see it in a moment. And if you can do that, that's not a problem, right? If you can see all the information more quickly, it's going to be way easier to make that decision. Especially when you talk about games with a bunch of like cards with words on them, or that kind of thing. A game that actually really hurts, even though it looks great. Well, depending on if you like this style, it goes well with this aesthetic, but it hurts the gameplay, is Sentinels of the Multiverse. Which has a bunch of games with flashy art. You know, everyone's got their cards in their hand. Sure, after you've played a while, maybe you memorize what every deck has in it. But generally speaking, you have to like lean over, read that card. Wait, what was the card 6 places over here? And you have these 2 things, and then you have that thing below you that does this thing. And oh, so that means that I can do this. Whereas you can't just look over and just like, there aren't like big icons on the cards or anything like that, where you can just be like, okay, so I see 3 green dots over there. That means this. There are games that do this better and worse. And
when you said cards with words games, that's the one that I thought of.
Yeah. I mean, it's a perfect example of maybe the aesthetics getting in the way. I mean, you know, once you've played it enough, it's not a problem, right? But it's definitely a thing.
Yeah, now, at least in that one, since it's a co-op, like you can just, you know, ask, hey, what does that card do again? You know, like, you know, what's the power on that card there that you played? Like stuff like that. But yeah, you're right. It's not a glanceable state. I like that expression, like a glanceable state, where you can just, you know, gather all the information very rapidly and understandably. I think that's a great way to think about it. Yeah.
The worst game for just glanceable information that could have been so much better was the first edition, I haven't seen recent printings, of Shadowhunters. And really a lot of those early 2000s era Japanese games that came over, the text was in like weird typefaces, like really weird, small, not enough space for that type. That type is black on dark gray and it's over there. And, you know, you just have to memorize these art, because you can't, like, you can't even read it from far away. What does it do? I don't know. It's just a card. But it feels like the industry is getting way better on that from a production standpoint. But even when you're making your game, you need to have some sort of system in place so that you can make sure it's working without someone having to polish it to make it work.
You know, and talking about a glanceable state, I was thinking about this when you mentioned that and some of the benefits of Sentinels being a cooperative game is that sometimes one of the problems you might be trying to solve that causes you analysis paralysis could have like six different parts. And what you do is you're like, oh, this part of the problem is this. And you have solved that part. But then while you're trying to solve the other parts, you forget the solution to the first part and you solve it again. But something like in a co-op game, those people can help you remember the things that you've already solved, and having like a glanceable way to remember the parts of the problem that you've already solved, or maybe just a part of the game that whenever you, as soon as you solve a part of the problem that you're trying to solve, you can just do it instead of having to hold all that information in your head and potentially have to resolve it in the future.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But of course, that sort of stuff, be like, oh, well, everyone can just keep up with it and coordinate. And what you do there is you lead yourself to a quarterbacking problem, which is probably also another episode.
Well, that was the last two episodes.
There are a lot of ways you can go wrong, and we've probably done all of them.
I think related to this one, in addition to having like a glanceable game state, an understandable glanceable game state, is if you have a game where you would have cards that have like a special ability and the trigger for that is like the art, but there's no hint as to what the ability is, and you actually have to go like look in the rule book or something, like that is also unclear game UX.
Yeah.
I played Warlock a couple of months ago, which is a really interesting card game, but the graphic design in that game is so poor because you constantly have to refer back to your little player aid card in order to decipher what the artwork and symbols are supposed to mean, that it actually greatly reduces the enjoyment of that game. And if that game would have had a much improved graphic design, and they very easily could have incorporated that player aid card on the actual cards at the reduction of, you know, making the artwork front and center. But it would have made the game so much more playable. And I probably would have kept it if it was actually, you know, playable. But it was so frustrating to play that I'm like, I'm just going to sell it because I don't want to fight the game in order to play it, you know? And because people had to constantly look at the player aid card, that contributed to AP greatly in that game for what should have been, you know, a relatively snappy decision. But you just have to, okay, so this card, okay, it can do this power. And if I play it here, what does that mean? Okay, it'll have this effect. And yeah, it was just real frustrating to play simply because it had an unclear UX in the game. So yeah, I think that, you know, for those of us who aren't graphic designers, this can be hard, but you know, you just got to look at games that do have good graphic design and study what they do well and why it works, and do a lot of playtesting with people who don't have a lot of experience with the prototype and see, you know, where they're struggling and to try to identify those things, and, you know, ideally work with a really good graphic designer who can really help and make your game not have a bad UX.
Yeah, but even just from the prototype stage, one thing I would say for non-designers is a really good rule of thumb is put whatever you're trying to test on the other side of the table, like the longest table you got, the other side upside down, and think, is there anything I can do to make it easier for me to see what that is from over here? And that's a pretty good base test. It doesn't have to be pretty. You just have to be able to know what it is.
Yeah, I think that's a great tip. So the next cause I want to talk about here is the inability to have outside opinions for a decision. And so this, once again, happens a lot in multiplayer competitive Euro games where you are analyzing your decision options, and because it's a competitive game, you're trying to make the decision for you, and you are competing against the other players, so you can't exactly ask them for help. I mean, you could, right, depending on your game group, and they might like give you suggestions on what to do. And perhaps if you're sitting there churning your mental wheels long enough, they're gonna give you suggestions anyway. But that's something, because you can't seek an outside opinion, that can really kind of contribute to some AP.
I think maybe even a worse case of it is in like a social game. Where it's not that you can't seek it, or there's no motivation for people to help you, so much as if you reveal what it is you're calculating, that is disadvantageous to you.
Right.
So it's harder to make a decision when it has to all be in your head. You can't be like looking over things. You need to like make sure you're not giving away where you're looking, what you're looking at, what you're considering. And that makes it much tougher to think through things sometimes.
Right. Right. And so I think the key thing here for designers to consider is kind of when you're playtesting, if you're playtesting, you know, with like the same group, like we often do, is to be really cognizant of, you are playtesting in a manner that's probably not going to be the same as people are playing. And you will have the ability to kind of interject with opinions and outside advice that may not happen when the game is really played. So you have to be very watchful about those types of interactions when you're playtesting, because those can't or probably can't happen when the game is actually out there. And if you're seeing those things happen, that is probably leading to probably one of the other causes of AP that we are talking about. And you really want to dig down into to see what the root issue is. Of course, if you can make the game like a co-op or a team-based game or something like that, you know, that could also solve the problem.
Yeah.
Who knows? That might make it interesting too, you know?
Yeah, I think there's this huge temptation when you're almost done with the game and you're getting it out to wider playtesting to people who don't necessarily, you know, they're not in your game group. They don't play things as much. Something like an unpub. In that situation, to like help people play the game so they understand it. It's their first time playing, right? They want to understand what they're doing. Well, here's what you can do. And that's beneficial to a degree, but also if you do that all the time, then there's really that risk that you've created a game that will have a lot of AP without you just standing there. And I mean, I don't think your plan is to take the game on the road and stand next to everyone who plays it. So it can really cover up that sort of problem.
Yeah, totally agree. Yeah.
Yeah, I was just thinking about, you know, the first time that you play as Mr. X in Scotland Yard, if you are not comfortable with your decision making, because the other players are already just kind of sitting there doing nothing while you're making your decision. And if that's one of the ones that kind of goes on, or if you have a question, you can't ask anybody, because as soon as you ask a question, you've lost.
Yeah. Am I allowed to move to spot 105? Oh, damn. Yeah. 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 And the Letters for Whitechapel is the same way, because it's a very similar game. That is a tough one if you are playing either Mr. X or Jack or something like that, and you are on your own, and yeah, that can be a tough one for decision making if you're trying to process something and you have no one else to lean on. Mark, pick out another one to talk about.
All right, games that have unclear objectives are also games that they can make it difficult to make quick decisions. Similar to whenever your actions, how they impact your progress toward a goal, is it makes it harder to weigh those decisions against other decisions in the same way. I remember when I was working more in earlier stages for Five Elements, and just the nature of your turns was separated enough from the goal of the game that it was difficult to see how you were making progress, or to even know which direction you should start moving in. And yeah, that would oftentimes lead people to either not know the value of any decision they're trying to make, which makes them, I guess, best case scenario, meaningless, and in worst case, meaningless and take forever to decide.
Yeah, I think related to this, in addition to like if your objective is unclear, if your objective is clear, but you can't see any path of getting there, I think, or at least like steps towards your objective, even if you don't see the full path, I think that can also be a source of AP.
like there's a sandbox game, Zaya, Legends of a Drift System, that has you get to really choose your own path. Whatever you want to do, you're allowed to do, basically. And one thing that could be difficult for some players is if they don't know what they want to do, then I guess it would have the same impact as, you know, playing Colorado without having a card already in front of you. Right. All the decisions, there's nothing making you lean towards one direction or the other.
So what do you do in Zaya, like, you know, at the beginning of the game? I haven't played it. I assume you have.
Well, so they do have, you do start with, there's small variable player powers on your starting ship. So there is some of that, but there's still there because you can gain points. You can make progress by trading, by blowing up people, by just doing cool things, by exploring, by doing missions, by smuggling. There's just any number of things are viable options. And so if you're at a point where you don't know, you don't have anything making you lean towards one of the options over the other, you know, I could see someone floating there aimlessly for a little bit trying to figure out, oh, should I go over here to pick up a new mission, or should I go try to shoot this guy, or should I, you know, try to do this cool thing to earn this title as being the best guy ever or whatever.
I'm the best starfighter pilot, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
So I think for this one, it's just, this one's tough to give like kind of concrete advice because who knows what the objective of the game might be or what style of game or things like that. But it's kind of paying attention to the decisions that players are making during a play test and kind of checking in, I think, to like, okay, do you have like a good idea of like what you should be doing in the game, you know, or are you feeling kind of foggy and lost at sea? And just trying to make sure that players have a big enough flashlight so they can light up enough of the room so they can at least have a direction and they're not standing in a dark room with no idea what's around or where they're trying to go.
Yeah, and it can be even harder if you're behind in a game that doesn't have a clear way to get yourself back in the running. And then, yeah, you're looking at all the options and none of them seem like the right option that can get you even within, you know, throwing distance of winning the game. Mm-hmm. Then all of a sudden, yeah, I have a difficult problem and I have no idea how to solve it.
Yeah, and that's a tough nut to crack in game design.
There's a case study of two very similar games from the same developer that have very... They're almost the same game, but the levels of AP between the two are so profound because of some clear design decisions. And that's Suburbia and Castles of Mad King Ludwig. And we've been talking about all these different like ways that you can go wrong. And it's kind of all a checkbox for Castles of Mad King Ludwig. I don't know how much experience you guys have with either game, but they're very similar. They both have like the... You know, you look at them on the table, they have similar markets, you're always buying a thing and you're putting it in your area, building out your tableau. But the changes that Castles makes to the Suburbia formula all increase AP, every single one that they do. Only the different shapes of the rooms you're putting in your castle make a different layer of sure, which one do you want, but also can you fit it? You always have to worry about that. The market for Suburbia, you know, something will come in at the top and something will disappear. But generally speaking, most of the information is pretty close to what it was last turn. With Castles, every turn, everybody has to switch something around, which not only is AP for the person setting the market and having to decide like how much they want to price everything. And then it's a whole level of AP for everyone once they've done it, because all of the prices of everything has changed. And that's kind of crazy. You know, there are so many aspects to that game, and to be clear, I kind of like both of them, but you look at those games side by side and you see how much smoother Suburbia is as a game and how much more you have to sit there and figure things out with Castles.
Do you feel like Suburbia has fewer or less interesting decisions because of all those things they've done that Castles does not do?
You know, just from my tastes, like, you know, these are all subjective things. I think there's a lot already in Suburbia and there's more in Castles. Like, if you don't think Suburbia has enough to it, then yeah, okay, Castles is your game. But with Suburbia, you already have, you know, these three layers of things where you put things in your area, what you buy, what you keep other people from buying, you know, going for goals. There's so many levels of that already that I don't feel there's anything lacking in that game. But you know, there's definitely the case where, you know, there's a lot more crunchiness to to castles, and that could be a benefit. But like, even you talk about glanceable information, you know, all the information you need for the tiles on Suburbia are on the tiles in Suburbia. You play castles and you have the tiles, then you have a little crib sheet for like, oh wait, these do what when I have this, and this one's only half the time. And then, you know, there is, it's one extra layer for having to look at your tableau, at what's available over to the side. And I think just all the stuff we're talking about kind of hits castles in all these ways.
Now that's fascinating, because I wonder if you're going to have a minority opinion in this one, because now I've played Suburbia, but I haven't played Castles of Mad King Ludwig yet.
And again, I don't think Castles is a bad game. I like both of these games, but if you don't like AP, then you won't like Castles, because yeah, there's just objectively more of it.
So I'm wondering, I don't know, maybe AP in a game is not as big of a detriment as perhaps I think it is, because Suburbia right now is ranked 69 on BGG, and Castles is ranked 51. And
that doesn't surprise me.
Yeah. So
the type of people who like long, crunchy games with a bunch of analysis paralysis are more likely to be members of Board Game Geek.
Yeah,
right?
Maybe.
When you're talking about reducing analysis paralysis, what you're really trying to do is help people who say will play board games with you but aren't necessarily on there. Definitely people who are not playing everything all the time are more sensitive to this, are more like they're more ready to give up on a game if it's causing them frustration, or if someone else at the table is making the thing take too long. So I'm not surprised by that.
Okay. So yeah, that, I mean, I don't know. That's just fascinating. Like, to me, and clearly I am not in the exact target for BGG, but if a game has worse AP, to me, that's a worse game. But perhaps I am in the minority in that opinion.
Well,
then
we should get some shirts made. Wait, we did get shirts made. Thank you for that.
Yeah, I know this is something we talking about later, but I think this is very interesting, kind of the relationship between richness of decisions and amount of AP possible. Because, I mean, up until you said that, I was thinking that they're not on the same scale. It's not like there's an inverse correlation. I mean, you haven't completely convinced me that I was wrong, but because I know there are games that you cannot see far into the future, yet still have long-term strategy as to how you're going to play it. And yeah, I was like, not seeing far into the future drastically reduces the amount of analysis you can even do, but you can still kind of play for the future.
I mean, poker, right?
Yeah, that's a very popular example. Absolutely. Yeah, like you're playing this hand. At the end of this hand, most of all of the information is wiped except for some of it. So you're playing the strategic game, trying to kind of force the table to play by your rules and your metagame, I guess. Yeah.
Yeah, and I think that's a good example. There are two basic types of games where this sort of, you know, thinking it through is more of the game than it is a detriment to the game. And it's games like chess, and it's games like poker. It's games where you're like trying to beat the odds with someone by like analyzing it further and making a smart play with what you've got. And then there's this sort of perfect information thing where it really is like, who is the best at calculating? But I think there are board games that aren't trying to be either of those things. And in that third category, that's where analysis paralysis really is maybe more universally a problem than it is an asset.
Okay. So let's talk about that a little bit more. So
sure.
We got a question on Twitter from Matthew Ramsey, who asks, how do you strike the balance between AP and, you know, richness and depth and meaningful decisions? And I would add on to that, is that a fair kind of comparison or scale, or is AP and richness and of depth and meaningful decisions, is that a false dichotomy? So I don't know, Graham. It's a big question. Yeah. What do you think?
I mean, I think there's correlation. I don't think it's necessarily one-to-one. I don't think like having like removing AP and removing interesting decisions are exactly the same thing. It's definitely true. The more decisions you put into a game, the harder decisions you put into a game, the more likely you are to run into these sorts of problems. And, you know, and I think you can go for a higher bar or a lower bar. That's definitely a case for castles too, right? Is that suburbia already exists. So we're not going to make suburbia. We're going to go over here and make this thing that is crunchier. It's not for that audience. It's over here. It's going to require more thinking. But I think you can have really interesting decisions without having as much AP. And you can have a bunch of AP without making interesting decisions. But I'd imagine that the ideal, the mean is something akin to a line, right? Than it is a scatter plot. And it's trying to get closer to that diagonal, making your decisions as interesting as you can without pushing AP or bringing the AP in without hurting your decisions. That you can always go too far. You can always say, well, oh, people are taking too long to make a decision, so we'll just hand them a decision. That's not great either, right?
Yeah.
So yeah, it's definitely a fair question. And I think the answer is like game design, right? It's not something we can sit here like, how do you do that? It's the whole process, you know? The whole challenge of what we
do. Here's an example that I think is a very interesting example. So High Society, another Kinesia game.
Mm-hmm.
That that game, when it is your turn to make a decision, there are not many like honestly viable choices. There, like, you might have, you know, you're gonna bid some amount of money, but because you don't get to make change or whatever, the amount of viable decisions is really like two or three real options. But each of those options has a enormous impact on your ability to play the game for the rest of the game. So each decision is super weighty, but because you don't even know what you're gonna be bidding on in 5 minutes, and you don't even know if there's so many unknowns that you can't really analyze it too much, even though each of your decisions has a profound impact on your long-term strategy. But you only have like two or three honestly viable options each turn. That's one that I think has a long-term, I mean, long-term is a short game, you know, 20 or 30 minutes, but it's got long-term strategy and very weighty decisions. But I think it avoids analysis paralysis by just having fewer viable options, even from the get-go. You're not going to, I mean, there are some choices that are just completely ridiculous, and you're going to immediately, you know, wipe them from your table of viable options just because they're so ridiculous. And you're left with just a few choices to consider.
Yeah. I mean, you're either going to increase the bid or you're going to pass. And if you choose to increase the bid, then you just have to decide by how much. And
yeah, because clearly increasing it by $25 million is ridiculous. I mean, that's a technically an option, but you're not going to do that.
Right. So listeners, if you're not familiar with High Society, the way it works real quick is you're trying to get the most valuable goods because you're trying to be a Richie Rich who owns all the most prestigious stuff. And everyone starts with the exact same amount of money and the exact same distribution of cards. And you have like, one's like a $25 million card and like a $20 million card. I think a 15, 12, 10, 8, 6, 4, 2, 1, something like that.
And I know there's 11 cards. Yeah, whatever.
Something like that.
If you want to make your own print and make your own version, you're going to need to do a little more research than this podcast.
Yes. And actually, I would just encourage buying it because it's a great game and it's not expensive. Right. But anyway, so each round, you reveal a card from the center of the the loot pile. And that's going to be numbers 1 through 10 with a couple special ability cards and a couple red cards that are going to eventually trigger the end of the game. And all you're doing is you're going around and you're either bidding on that thing and increasing whatever bid is currently there, or you're passing. And if you are increasing a bid, you can never take cards back from a previous bid that you did that round. If you are passing, then you get all your cards back that you have already bid for the round, with one exception for the red cards. The twist is whoever has the least amount of money at the end of the game is just out. They can't win. So you have to balance, like, I need to bid. I need to bid high because I got to win these nice expensive items and be the best Richie Rich in the game. But I can't spend too much because if I do, I just can't win at the end of the game. And that's acceptable because it is like a 30-minute game, so it doesn't go for 2 hours. And you don't feel like you just wasted 2 hours if you're suddenly just very hurtfully eliminated because you spent too much money.
I mean, that is a twist. I think the bigger twist is that you can't make change. Once you lose that $6 million, you never have that $6 million denomination anymore. So you can never increase a bid by that $6 million card. So every time you increase it by a small amount, that reduces your ability to increase it by a small amount in the future.
Right.
And so playing that 1 million, which is like the least valuable card, is a huge deal because it's also one of the most valuable cards, because sometimes you just need to bump it up by 1 million to be able to win the bid.
Right. Yeah. Oh, no, I totally agree. But and I was referring to like Twist in terms of like over other bidding games. But yeah, the method of bidding and when you're choosing to use which card and when you're choosing to increase a bid or pass, fantastically deep decisions in that game. But I think you're exactly right, Mark, that the number of decisions that you're considering are not vast. And that, at least for me, is what reduces the AP in that game. It's really is you're considering one, two, or three things, or it's really like I'm either passing or I'm bidding, and if I choose the bid, then it's how much and which of these cards am I going to use, and that is not something that generally will trigger a lot of AP. But there's a ton of rich and meaningful decisions to make in that game.
I think more generally, especially for our audience, a lot of people working on game design, the biggest pitfall you can make is conflating interesting and deep decisions with more decisions.
Yeah.
That, like, I've seen so many starting designers be like, here's my game and here are the 32 things you can do. And oh, man, like, it gets so complex, and that's great. Like, well, no, it just gets complicated. So I think if you can make good decisions, like you're talking about in High Society, if you can make these rich, meaningful things on their own, then you don't have to layer on seven other systems to make it interesting. And, not that you shouldn't layer like two or three, right? Like, that can be really interesting. But make sure what you're doing is good, and that way you don't need to put all these, interlocking systems just to make them interesting if they aren't otherwise interesting.
Yeah, I would suspect that the relationship between AP and, like really deep and meaningful decisions is probably some type of like four quadrant plot where, where AP is one of the axes and your decisions are the other axis. And ideally you want to be in like two of those quadrants and you don't want to be in the other two,
Yeah.
You either want like really, really deep decisions and AP, or you want really deep decisions and no AP. If you have, non-interesting decisions and AP, that's terrible, And if you have non-interesting decisions and no AP, you've probably made Uno, which is not the worst thing in the world, but that's probably...
Munchkin. Yeah.
Right. It can be successful. Flux. Yeah.
Yeah.
But that's probably not going to be a game that is well thought of. Yeah.
Let me make a different analogy that has a slightly different conclusion than yours.
Okay, good.
I think that the dichotomy between analysis paralysis and interesting, robust decisions, there is a line that goes back and forth between them. But I think that line is a line that is grounded in average game design. And I think that there is a way to design just at a higher level that has the depth and the richness of decisions without bringing along that analysis process, to kind of raise it above that line of the dichotomy, to include one without including the other and not having to find a balance, but to have everything.
Yeah, basically less of a line and more of a threshold, that being as much below it as possible is great. There's maybe more tolerance as you get like more complex and deep decisions for some AP, but it's ideal to, and it's the sign of a great game if you've made it where you are as far away from that line as possible and safer in lower AP.
Yeah.
All right. Is there anything else we want to talk about when it comes to analysis paralysis?
I have one place where I think it might not matter at all.
Okay.
And that is if you are designing a game solely meant to be played single player, then I think that's not even a variable to have in your consideration. If it's fun, then regardless of how much it allows people to sit there and think about it, I mean, because sitting there by yourself thinking about stuff is the fun of playing a single player game.
If you're playing a single player game as fast as your hand can move the pieces, then that's a really bad single player game, right? Like, the problem there is, like, well, okay, like, if nothing's actually making you stop and think about what you're doing and you're just going through the motions all the time, then, yeah, that's not a great single-player game.
Well, then it's just, like, Jax or, you know, something like that, and it's just a
different... You play single-player type. Jax?
Like, if you're trying to, you know, like, just do it as fast as you can, like... and beat your personal, you know, speed. Like, yeah, it's
exercise, I guess.
Okay,
right?
let's not get into like activity versus game here.
Yeah, but, I mean, it's like, let's see how fast I can pick up these jacks. I mean, sure.
Yeah,
I just don't think that's our area to address at all. I'm not saying that's not.
We're not going to.
I just think we can't speak of it.
Yeah. But yeah, Mark, you're. I think that's a really good call out, though. Is like, yeah, solo games, at least. As far as I can see, they don't need to worry about AP at all. If someone out there, if you design solo games and you disagree with that, I would be very interested to hear your opinion on why you think AP does matter for a solo design. Is that it doesn't seem like it would, at least from my viewpoint.
I still think there are a lot of things we talked about that they should absolutely work on. Like, you should have glanceable information. You should make sure your game is as playable as possible and reduce that AP. It's acceptable for it to be there, but do consider that you can make it easier on your players, even in a solo game, to play and know what's going on.
Right, yeah. Yep, I definitely agree with that. So let's go into our news segment here. So I have two pieces of news. The first one is Belle of the Ball by group member Daniel Solis is getting a second printing, and it should be in stores in December, I believe. And so that's real exciting. I know there are a couple minor tweaks to the game and the rule book, but it's largely the same game. So if you've been looking for Belle of the Ball, keep an eye out. It should be in stores pretty soon.
Yeah, Daniel did such a great job with that game. And it's just a great example of how to follow some very non-traditional ideas to a full product. Like, there are so many things about that game that go the opposite of what games do. It's not about combat. It's not about any of those things. And yet it's successful at what it does.
Yeah. And the other piece of news is also for Daniel. He has... two new releases that are available through Drive-Thru Cards, and the links will be in the show notes.
Yeah, and they got tuck boxes.
Yeah. So the first one is Curse You, Robin Hood, which I have not played yet. I'm looking forward to playing that one.
Yeah, I did a lot of testing on that one, and it's he made it in at a convention with a lot of help, and that game got off the ground. It's so great. So it's definitely worth checking out.
And the other one is I Can't Even With These Monsters, with an exclamation point, which is all about trying to not have an even score at the end of the game. Because if you do, you can't win unless everyone has an even score. And then I forget what the win condition is at that point. So that's actually another example of like a short game where you could potentially just be straight out eliminated. But it's okay because it's short. And that one is... really kind of reminds me of real similar spirit of like Trickster, you know, where you're doing a lot of similar things that you do in card games, but there's a big twist in it that is very appealing. And as Graham mentioned, both of these have tuck boxes that are available as an option. I think it's a $2 add-on, but don't quote me on that. But you get a really nice tuck box that is foldable without any glue, and they're really rigid, and they look great. So if you like,
I've looked at one of these tuck boxes, and I think they are good. I give them a thumbs up.
There was no AP behind that decision. Yeah.
No.
Okay. So Mark, if someone would like to get in contact with you, where can they do so?
My Twitter handle is mmark40, and on Board Game Geek, I'm in there as Meshnaster, which is spelled the way that you would imagine if you were spelling that word. It'll get me.
And Graham, where can people contact you?
Yeah, they should hit me up on Twitter. I'm at Color Ninja, or they can just show up to our guild on Board Game Geek and say hi to me, where I probably talk more than people want me to.
Nah, that's not true.
I promise if someone posts on the guild, I will see it.
Speaking of the guild, if you go to podcast.gdofnc.com, that's going to redirect you to our podcast guild on BGG. Please consider joining in on the conversation. We'd love to have opinions from listeners. Whether you agree or disagree with us, either is great. Anything that kind of generates a conversation is a good thing.
If you're having trouble deciding whether or not to do it, just do it.
Yeah.
You know, don't let AP stop you from,
that's right,
from talking with us.
Yeah, don't let shyness contribute to AP. we also have a group Twitter account that you can follow, which is @GDofNC, which of course stands for Game Designers of North Carolina. And if you'd like to follow me on Twitter, I am @MattWolf with an E on the end of Wolf. And that is going to do it for this episode of the Game Designers of North Carolina podcast. Remember to, give me a second. Just give me a second.